This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the ban on natural gas drilling called hydrofracking, which Governor Cuomo plans to lift in 60 days.
We thought we had it stopped, but it looks like Cuomo's making a deal. Close our atomic energy plant, Indian Point. Give us hydrofracking instead. Not just here in New York, where Cuomo's doing it, but apparently it's going to happen all over the United States. It's a real environmental danger.
We also speak with New York professor Kostas Panayiotakis, who joins us from Greece, where he's observing the huge social upheaval protesting the austerity measures that the government there has levied against the Greek people.
Whether it's in Greece or Madison, Wisconsin, we're seeing a worldwide reaction to the austerity measures governments and banks are imposing on working-class people throughout the world. Greece is now the epicenter.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there was quite a troubling news story about a Somali citizen captured on the high seas, detained in jail for 2 months, not given any rights, and now being brought to the United States for trial. What's wrong with that?
Well, the first thing that strikes you about it is that this guy was kept on a U.S. ship since April 19th. April, May, June, you know, over 2 months, 2.5 months on a ship. And did any of us know about him? What was he doing on the ship? What was going on there? It's troubling, the idea that the U.S. could simply capture somebody, wherever they captured him, and we'll talk about that in a second, put him on a ship, and then for 2 months, according to the United States, they questioned him. They didn't read him any of his Miranda rights or give him a lawyer or give him a right to habeas corpus or anything. They just questioned him. And they said after 2 months, when he'd actually talked quite a bit, apparently, according to the U.S., they then read him his Miranda rights, and then he continued talking. So it's a very, very terrible situation in a number of ways. One is, what was their right to simply detain this guy, put him on a ship on the high seas? Is it essentially a floating Guantanamo before we were able to get attorneys at Guantanamo? And then what right did they have to continue to question him and then 2 months on read him the Miranda warnings? And what good is that? And then, of course, the only maybe positive thing in this is that they're at least going to try him in an Article III court in the United States in New York. But, of course, that's after probably, who knows how, getting this confession out of this guy or whatever he said after these months on the boat. There's a lot of questions we don't know. But the first thing that strikes me is the idea that you can use a U.S. floating prison floating out there off Somalia somewhere, pick people up, stick them in there, not give them attorneys, strikes me as really bad. It's like we won Guantanamo in many respects, getting the right to lawyers and habeas corpus. But if they then float Guantanamos all over the world, what do we get? Now, we talk about the law a little bit. It's pretty interesting. First, the question is, where is the guy picked up? The initial reports were that he was picked up somewhere in the Gulf. And they don't say whether on land or on sea. Now, obviously, he's picked up on land. Then there's serious questions about the integrity of states violating the borders, et cetera. If he's picked up on the high seas, of course, it's probably slightly better for the United States. But it's not clear yet. The United States is now apparently claiming, at least in some legal papers, that he was picked up on the high seas. But we just don't know. The first reports were somewhere in the Gulf. Then the question is, what was the authority to pick him up? Now, that's where it gets into a position I've had on this program for a long time, in the center's position, is that you can't just pick up people anywhere in the world and detain them under, quote, the laws of war, because it's our view that the laws of war don't apply in these cases. These are alleged terrorists that the U.S., yes, may have a right under the right circumstances to arrest them and bring them to trial, but they don't have the right under the laws of war to simply claim it's a war, pick these people up, hold them in detention, and then decide when and if they're going to try him. Under the U.S.'s theory, they could have held this guy forever because he's this alleged enemy combatant or whatever term you want to use. So the whole authority for detention, which the Obama administration is claiming somehow under the laws of war or under that famous statute, the authorization to use military force from 2001, is very questionable. On our listserv, when we're discussing this, someone said, well, what do you think of? Well, I said, I think if they had the reasonable belief or cause to arrest somebody on the high seas. They may have had that authority, but then they don't have the authority to keep him for months. They have to transport him to a court and give him a lawyer immediately. That's the center's position. That's my position. Others say, well, the laws of war, they had the AUMF that allowed you to go to war with anybody involved in 9/11. So that's the second point. Even if you somehow accept that the AUMF, the Authorization to Use Military Force, allows you to pick up Al-Qaeda in a military confrontation or anybody in 9/11, why are they picking up his name? It happens to be Mr. Wasami. Mr. Wasami, it is claimed, had a relationship with a Somalia domestic alleged terrorist group called Al-Shabaab, and possibly a relationship with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Now, Al-Shabaab is strictly domestic Somalia group, nothing to do with 9/11. And the idea that President Obama would be using a statute passed 10 years ago almost, relevant to 9/11, as authority to pick up some guy in Somalia is completely bizarre. And it's not clear that Obama is doing that. He's somehow now asserting it's just the general laws of war that allow him to pick him up. And because it's taking the authorization to use military force and stretching it way beyond belief. So we have these questions. Where was he picked up? When I think there's no military authority, I think he ought to be picked up civilian. And then the third question is, now that he's being brought to the United States or New York for trial, what about the fact that he didn't have his Miranda rights read? Well, they're clearly not going to be able to use any statements that he made before he got his Miranda rights in the 2 months of questioning. But of course, from that, they then knew everything he had to say. They give him Miranda rights, and what do you think they say? They say, well, now you have your Miranda rights, but you know, we know all the answers. Were you here? Were you here? Were you here? Admit it. So it's like a BS Miranda rights. It's really serious. I mean, this idea that the U.S., I mean, that's it, Michael, to me, that the U.S. can pick up someone anywhere in the world, stick them on a ship for months, question them. We can never hear from the guy.
The authorization to use military force was hollow to begin with because they declared war not on another country, but essentially on a tactic, on terrorism. And they did this 10 years ago to authorize what they've been doing the last 10 years. And now Somalia, which was not even part of this, they're using that 10-year authorization to go after somebody who wasn't even part of this in Somalia, which means essentially they got a blank check to go after anybody, and then putting them on a floating Guantanamo, as you put it, is really scary. It's amazing how ingenious and flexible these lawbreakers are.
Right. In short, I think that they may have well crossed another border to pick him up, that they didn't have the authority under U.S. law to pick him up because it would be a real stretch for the AUMF, which was related to 9/11, to be used to pick some guy up who's not related to 9/11. Third, that there's no authority, therefore, for Obama to have picked him up because there's no authorization through the AMF. And fourth, under international humanitarian law, which is the laws of war, there's no war here. I mean, there's no war. Yeah, the U.S. is using some military force, but this is not an armed conflict we're having with a bunch of, you know, alleged terrorists in Somalia. So there's no authority under the laws of war, which means he has to be treated under regular criminal law, like you arrest someone, whether it's in New York or on the high seas, and be brought here and be given a lawyer and Miranda rights, and be given those rights not 2.5 months over 2 months later.
You know, as disturbing as this is for those of us at the center who believe in the rule of law, it's not that surprising. Given Obama's position that they could attack Libya, that wasn't a war.
I think you're right to mention Libya. Combine Libya with this operation of capturing a Somalian man, holding him for months on a ship, just shows that they're willing to use war whenever they want, without Congress, however they want.
You remember, with Libya, they said that they could do what they're doing, which includes drone strikes, Air Force, spending about $1 billion so far on these military activities, trying to assassinate the head of state of Libya. And they're saying that all of this is not war.
The question for all of us and our listeners is, how many ships right now are floating around the world with prisons on them of people the U.S. has picked up all over the world who we know nothing about?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's serious to me. Incommunicado detention is something we used to associate with the Pinochet regime in Chile or the Argentines. Well, now it's clearly, it's come home right squarely in the United States.
Michael, the actions that the Obama administration took against Libya is really a perversion of the law. Explain what they did in order to justify not going to Congress.
Well, the use of military force by the president has to be authorized by Congress under the United States Constitution. That's very clear. And it's not just war. It's use of its hostilities. It's really almost any military action anywhere in the world other than in self-defense, real self-defense. So we start from the premise that military actions, whether in Libya or killing people in Somalia or Yemen, etc., has to be authorized by Congress. In some cases, the president claimed that the authorization to use military force passed in 2001 after 9/11 gave him that authority. But in other cases, he's just asserting raw, naked power, and he's claiming that because these don't amount to large wars, that the Constitution doesn't apply and he doesn't have to go to Congress. Now, then what happened is, because this is a common claim of presidents, whether it's in Libya or Somalia, Congress, after Vietnam, built in a safety trigger. They said, look, you still need our consent to go to war or to go into hostilities or bomb people, etc., but we're going to put in a safety trigger. If you do that, if you engage in hostilities and you don't come to us first, like you're required to do under the Constitution, then you have 60 days to come back to us and get authority, or within 60 days, all troops have to be automatically withdrawn. So it's a safety figure, because they knew the president would do exactly what Obama's doing, violate the Constitution. They put in a safety trigger that says you have 60 days to get authority. If you don't have authority, you then have 30 more days to get all the troops out, total of 90 days. So in the case of Libya, of course, the 90 days have passed, and the War Powers Resolution had required that all those troops be brought out. So we have a sort of double system. Is that clear, Michael?
Well, as a practical matter, the political will in this country is lacking to do anything. Technically, what he did is a crime and can be impeached for it and tried and gotten out of office. But I don't think that's going to happen.
It's a high crime or misdemeanor. It's true. It's a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of a congressional statute. You can impeach him. But good luck. We've never successfully impeached anybody. I mean, we had Andrew Johnson after the Civil War was at least tried and acquitted eventually, but I think that was the case. Nixon, rather than be impeached, resigned. Clinton made it through. Bush made it through. So what do you say, Michael? It looks like it's not a really good lever.
Michael, both of us have been very involved and supportive of the flotilla that attempted to break the siege of Gaza and expose the war crimes of Israel there and in the occupied territories, and a lot of people that were organizing this, and even a number of people that went over there were friends of ours, including Jane Hirschman and Richard Levy. Last week, Jane Hirschman sent out an email to the movement saying that they had declared victory and are coming home, and I thought it would be good if we read Jane's letter to our audience.
I just want to say the coverage of this has been terrific, particularly on Democracy Now! On July 6th, they had a really, as you and I said, Michael, a really wonderful interview with the boat organizers of the American flotilla boat. It was really moving to see it. Jane was one of the key organizers of the boat, and here's the letter she wrote to her supporters back home. In capital letters, "We are coming home Thursday." That's Thursday last week. "This part of the journey is over. Our captain is free. Our hunger strikers are free and eating again, and we are exhausted but committed to keep on keeping on. This has been a most extraordinary experience. Last night it ended with our going Syntagma Square, which looks much like Tahrir, where there's an encampment and thousands of people gather each night.
On Sundays, there may be upwards of 50,000, and on big nights, hundreds and hundreds of thousands. We unfurled to drumbeats 22 flags, sewn together representing the countries participating in the flotilla. Our black and white signs were in Greek, Arabic, and English. It was a beautiful sight. Then we marched to the Spanish embassy, where our Spanish partners were occupying its embassy demanding the release of their boat. We arrived at about 9 p.m. with drummers leading the way. They came out on balconies and we sang to each other. It was quite a sight. Richard and I are coming home with many stories to tell."
That's Richard Levy, who is Jane's partner and who was on the boat.
She goes on to say, "I feel our reach has been far. I was just told that at a small rural community in North Carolina, a pastor on Sunday gave a sermon about bearing witness."
He ended with the flotilla. "I feel that we were able to bring attention to the situation in Gaza, and the best part is that all of our people are going home safe and sound. We hope to catch up with all of you soon. Love, Jane, Hirschman, and Richard Levy.
It was a magnificent action that the comrades did over there in supporting and giving solidarity to the Palestinians. And we can't wait to hear more of the stories and continue with them, the actions to expose the Israeli crimes.
And it was incredibly brave. I mean, you understand, when you go out on, if you float out on the Mediterranean in the face of the Israeli Defense Forces, there's no guarantee that you will come back in one piece.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo plans to lift the moratorium now in place on natural gas drilling, known as hydraulic fracturing or hydrofracking. Plans to do this in about 60 days and is allowed for public comment before they allow the oil companies to go in and mine natural gas from what's called the Marcellus Shale, which covers much of the southern tier of New York State. Every time a well is drilled for these purposes, the oil and gas companies use an estimated 5 to 9 million gallons of water. Each time a well is fractured, it's another 5 to 9 million gallons of water. And a well can be fractured multiple times. In this process, up to 275 different toxic chemicals are used. So the process is both poisonous and carcinogenic. The whole scheme is being sold as one that will produce jobs, although critics of hydrofracking point out that the few jobs that are produced are usually with workers brought in from out of state in places like Texas. To get an update on all of this, we're joined by attorney Jordan Yeager. He's a National Lawyers Guild member and a cooperating attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and a member of the Damascus Citizens, a anti-hydrofracking organization. Jordan Yeager, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Jordan, we're going to talk a bit about hydrofracking today, which we've covered on the show before, but we're particularly, I guess, going to focus on what's going on in New York now with the possible lifting of a moratorium. But give us first a sense of what is hydrofracking?
Hydrofracking is part of a broader industrial process that is a very dangerous part and part of a dangerous process as a whole. Basically, what we're doing is allowing companies to drill down a mile deep through our aquifers, which we all depend on for our drinking water, and which our other businesses depend on to operate. We're allowing these companies to drill down a mile deep, and once they get down there, they start to drill horizontally. And when they drill horizontally, they've got what they're aiming at is the gas that is locked in the shale formations underground. In order to release the gas from the shale, they blast it with this combination of nasty stuff, including a lot of chemicals that they don't want to disclose. That then releases the gas back up through the borehole, and they send it off to market, or at least that's the theory. In doing that, they are exposing our aquifers not just to the chemicals that are used in the fracking process, but also to the migration of that gas into the drinking water. They're also developing, industrializing large swaths of land. And when they do that, they are polluting the waters of New York and Pennsylvania and every place where this is happening.
Well, you know, we got greeted the other day with the horrible news that Cuomo cut a deal and that he's letting the oil and gas companies do this in New York State with some exclusions, but nonetheless letting them do it. What's the danger? How many people are involved here? What's the worst case scenario?
Well, there's been a many-year review that's gone on. They closed the record for review of their preliminary study back in December of 2009. Now, since then, we've learned a lot about the dangers associated with this drilling process, but they haven't been studying what we're learning since 2009, and instead they issued a new set of findings last week, although they haven't been fully released yet. So they're still trickling out. And what they are proposing in very general terms, and it's a 900-page document that, you know, that everybody still has to digest, but what they're proposing in general terms is to allow something like 85% of the area of New York State that has Marcellus Shale to be open to drilling, that they would not allow drilling to take place in the New York City and Syracuse watersheds, and that they would not allow it to take place within what they call primary aquifers and on state-owned game lands. But all other places of private land, they would allow it to happen. And so they're proposing, in effect, to create two classes in New York, those who live in New York City and the Syracuse areas, that those people would be protected from this activity, but the people in the rest of the state would be subjected to it.
Isn't it obvious, Jordan, that the deal they cut is self-evidently dangerous because they're excluding some people and including other people? Aren't they admitting that the thing is dangerous?
That's what it certainly looks like. If they're saying we're not going to allow it in the city's watershed and in Syracuse's watershed, it seems like an implicit recognition, if not an explicit recognition, that it's too dangerous to allow it to happen there. And with good reason to find that. What we see from where the drilling has taken place in other parts of the country and the studies that have come out since they closed the record in December of 2009, that you can reasonably anticipate a contamination rate of 5.7%, which means that for every 17 or 18 gas wells that you drill, you can reasonably expect to see water contamination happening from that. And so there's clearly been a recognition that that risk is real and that we're not going to subject New York City and Syracuse drinking water. But then everybody ought to be asking why we'd allow the rest of the citizens of New York to be exposed to it.
So how do you explain it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I happen to live in New York City, and you know, we get our water from the Catskills, where they're not going to allow this kind of drilling. I mean, the Marcellus Shale just goes up to a little part of us, but still. So I feel like, you know, okay, great, my water's going to be okay. It just seems crazy to me. I mean, everything I read about it, put the well down, then they slant, or I guess they drill for, I don't know how long, but for quite a while. Then all the water that goes down, and there's poisons. I don't get it.
Right, and you know, and that's the thing. They go out, when they're drilling horizontally, they go out in excess of 2 miles. So they cover a large area. There is no good explanation for it.
So you mean even if I'm a farmer and I'm one that decides I'll rent my property to the oil company or the gas company, that if I'm a farmer 2 miles away and I decide not to, that the drill can go underneath my land? Is that possible?
What happens is they have leases with properties that are non-drilling leases. So to capture the minerals that are under somebody else's land, they still would need to deal with that landowner.
They've got a lot of money. They can go out and buy these people off, which is what they did in Pennsylvania.
But tell us about the dangers a little more. So, I mean, I understand they can poison the aquifer, but, you know, there was a long series in the New York Times about this and about the failure of the EPA, the National Environmental Protection Agency, to regulate this stuff very much. So I'd like, interested in the dangers, and of course, you're from Pennsylvania, and I think it's already going on there, and what's been the effect there?
It has been going on. It is not fully ramped up here yet, but it, particularly in the western part of the state and in more and more of the northern part of Pennsylvania, it is happening. And first of all, you're seeing large-scale industrialization of what was not just farmland, but woodlands throughout the state. With that, then you're seeing a degradation of water quality. And again, that's simply from the large-scale industrialization that's going on without even getting to the chemical dangers that we're dealing with. We've had incident that was widely reported and shown in the great movie Gasland about the contamination of the water supply in Dimmick. The people in Dimmick can't use their wells anymore, and that's happening throughout the state where communities are losing their ability to drink the water, and instead the water has to be trucked in. Even at a very simple level, the amount of water it takes to frack one of these wells is something like 5 million gallons, and you're talking about truck traffic that these communities have never seen. It's completely ruining the roads in the northern half of the state. It's tearing up the communities, and you know, we see in Bradford County, we had a blowout not too long ago, which then caused damage, again, not just to people's drinking water, but to the streams in that area. We are going to see continued failures wherever this happens. And the question is, are we going to allow it to happen? Are we going to force this practice to follow the science and only allow it to happen if the science says it can be done safely? And we're simply not there.
Well, the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York City is boosting this hoax by saying that it's going to provide jobs. And that's the trade-off, maybe a little bit of risk to the water. On the other hand, in all these poor rural communities, they're going to hire people and people are going to get at work. Is that true?
Well, in Pennsylvania, what we're seeing is that most of those jobs that they're talking about are going to folks from outside the state. They're bringing in people from from the Western states who have experience with drilling. But you also have to look at the broader economic impact. When a community loses its water supply, that has an economic impact that is beyond what the handful of jobs that get gained are. It's a short-term economic fix and causing long-term damage. You know, people also talk about trying to rid us of our dependence on foreign oil. We're going to be moving into a time in this country where we have to worry about dependence on foreign water. If we don't have clean water supplies for to live from and for our other businesses to use to operate, we're going to see much greater economic damage.
We're speaking with attorney Jordan Yeager, who practices law in Pennsylvania and is active with Damascus Citizens. Are you doing anything legally in Pennsylvania and with your organization to combat this?
We are. We're working with both Damascus Citizens for Sustainability and with the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. And currently, there have only been a handful of what's called exploratory wells that the gas companies have been able to drill in the Delaware River Basin. And so we've been fighting that battle and trying to protect the Delaware River Basin from the dangers of gas drilling. And so we've been involved both at the local level in dealing with how local communities can attempt to regulate where and how this activity takes place. We've been dealing with the Delaware River Basin Commission to try to make sure that they don't allow the Delaware to be poisoned by these activities. And we've been involved in some of the permit battles that have gone on. The state, you know, has a permitting process, and when residents live nearby and are unhappy with the permitting decisions, they can appeal to the Pennsylvania Environmental Hearing Board, and we've been involved in that process.
Jordan, a question about where it's going on. We know Pennsylvania. We know they're looking at New York. Where else in the country are they doing fracking, if anywhere?
Colorado has had a lot of it. Wyoming has had a lot of it. Texas. Dish, Texas, is a town. You've got the mayor has basically fled the city because of the way the community has been ruined by this activity. So there are folks from the western part of the country who have lived this and who have seen what the dangers are. They are a great resource for those of us in the east and have hope that when the people of Pennsylvania and the people of New York and the people of New Jersey are fully awakened to the dangers of this activity, that we'll be able to build a movement to really rein it in.
Let me ask a question about the use of energy, which you mentioned, and you know, dependence on foreign oil, and you mentioned we'll wind up having a dependence on foreign water. But the way it's played out in New York, I think, and this is, you know, fairly simplistic in a way, but Governor Cuomo a few weeks ago said he was going to insist that Indian Point, which is, you know, very close to New York City, it's a nuclear energy facility that gives New York City 20% of its electricity, and it's on a possible fault line. And their governor said he wants that nuclear plant closed. It's coming up for a new license. And I think most of us in New York think it ought to be closed. And then the question is, where's New York going to get its energy from? And so at the same time as he said it's going to be closed, he is about to announce or is in the process of announcing that 85% of the state is now going to be open to fracking. So it seems to me that they're playing off one against the other, and they're trying to say, well, you guys don't like nuclear energy. Well, your only alternative is fracking. And what do you say to all that?
There are dangers associated with these large industrial activities, and we have to look at the dangers in the broadest sense. And natural gas has been identified by some as a clean fuel, but that's simply when they compare how it burns to how coal burns. But that's just one part of the natural gas story. You also have to look at the dangers associated with the process of extraction, and that's what we've been talking about today. And then you have to look at a lot of the same kind of problems that you encounter with nuclear energy. When we drill down a mile deep, we're finding naturally occurring radioactive material. And when we, as part of the drilling process, we're then bringing that up to the surface. We're not only exposing our aquifers to it, we've now got radioactive waste that we need to deal with. And one of the terrible things that's happening in Pennsylvania is the drilling companies are allowed to bury that radioactive waste right on people's properties where the drills have been drilling. So now we're going to look at hot spots of this radioactive material scattered throughout our state and exposing future generations to yet another layer of harm. So, look, we need energy. There's no question we need energy. We have to decide what level of risk we're comfortable with the different choices. And my own view is that we ought to be doing, as a community, we ought to be making investments in renewable energy resources like solar, like wind, to make them affordable to people and to get them up to a large scale.
Jordan Yeager, what kind of cooperation are you and your group experiencing with groups in New York?
There's been good cooperation. We're all in this together, and I think people have recognized that. You know, when one of the things that we've seen in what's going on in the Delaware River Basin Commission is there's a recognition that what happens there is going to impact the communities in New York, and that collectively we're battling the same set of corporate interests, and we have to work together to make sure that we're finding all avenues that are available to us to do that.
The couple of groups that I'm familiar with here in New York are Catskill Mountain Keeper and NYH2O Frack Action. Can you give us, our listeners, an idea of what they might do in terms of websites to go to or what they can do to get involved in a protest? This, we only have a couple of months before it's going to come down on us.
Well, the groups that you mentioned are good places to start, and if you go online and Google those, go to Damascus Citizens for Sustainability's website, and certainly both the Delaware River Keeper Network and the Hudson River Keeper. Natural Resources Defense Council has a lot of great resources. Just to learn more, you can also go to the ProPublica site, which has done tremendous reporting on these issues. But by getting involved in those direct action groups, by sending a message to the governors of these states, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, they need to hear from folks. You know, one of the things that people need to be clear about now is that with this new direction from New York, we need to make sure that there's an adequate time for public participation. And what was announced last week is that they would only allow a 60-day public comment period. That's simply not enough. They haven't looked at the research that's been established since they closed the record on this in December of 2009. The public needs more than 60 days to be able to educate the folks at the state level about what we've been learning since December of 2009. We ought to be looking at least a six-month period for the public to be able to comment on what was proposed last week.
Jordan Yeager, thank you really very much for this amazingly informative interview, but also to getting people active on the issue. I mean, this place is going to look like a moonscape, this country, if we don't watch out.
That's what I was thinking, Michael. You know, we've done shows on mountaintop removal. Thankfully, there's no coal to be dug in New York State.
So thank you, Jordan, for your work on
this.
Thank you. We encourage our audience to get active.
Great. Thanks very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Where the road is dark and the seed is sown, where the gun is cocked as the bullet's cold, where the miles are marked in the blood and the gold, I'll meet you farther on up the road. Got on my dead man's suit and my smiling skull ring, my lucky graveyard boots and a song to sing. I got a song to sing. It keeps me out of the cold. And I'll meet you further on up the road. Further on up the road. Further on up the road. Where the way is dark and the night is cold, one sunny morning we'll rise, I know, and I'll meet you farther on up the road.
Protests and demonstration continue to erupt in Greece as demonstrators rise up in the streets against deep cuts in services and jobs lost from a newly imposed austerity program. Austerity imposes on a society a severe regimen of government cuts to please and satisfy these creditor banks. Greece, as predicted by economics professor Rick Wolf, who over a year ago on Law and Disorder predicted it would be hit the hardest by the global economic disaster. Unfortunately, Rick was right. The austerity program has cut into working class jobs as the country privatizes the post office, gas company, waterworks, railways, and almost every other public service. It's important to look at Greece because what is occurring in Greece in a massive way has already started here in the United States. Today, we're pleased to be joined by Kostas Panayiotakis, an assistant professor at New York City College of Technology, where he teaches social theory, political economy, and environmental sociology.
Professor Kostas Panayiotakis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be on your show.
We're in our studios here at WBAI, and you're a third of the way around the world. Where are you?
Now I'm in a small town in Greece, about 100 miles from Athens. I was in Athens for the last few days, and I came here just yesterday.
That's precisely what we were hoping, because we'd like a direct report on what's going on there. How did Greece get into the situation they're in? What caused the terrible problems that they have now?
Well, what you have in the European Union, you have imbalances that resulted partly out of the introduction of the euro, but also by the more general phenomenon, even on a global level, the division of the world into some countries that are sort of more technologically advanced and economically dynamic, and others that are not. So in the same way you have a kind of global north, global south divide around the world, there is a similar kind of divide between the sort of most affluent countries in Europe, for example, Germany, France, northern European countries, and the periphery, including Greece, Portugal, Ireland, that are now having troubles. So right now you have a crisis that is sort of a European crisis. It's partly a manifestation of a global crisis. So it's not purely a matter of some kind of pathological Greek culture or something. Oftentimes mainstream media present Greeks as being, you know, profligate and so on and so forth. But of course, you know, the crisis in Greece has its own specificities in the same ways that the crisis in Ireland or Portugal might have its specificities. One of the specificities in the case of Greece is that basically the wealthy are not paying taxes. There are sort of tax evasion problems. There have been policies in recent years that have reduced the taxes that businesses are supposed to pay. So the problem in Greece is primarily a problem of revenues rather than spending. People oftentimes, when you listen to mainstream media, they talk about a bloated public sector in Greece. I mean, the public sector in Greece is in line with the public sector in other developed countries. And now what they're trying to do, of course, is drastic cutbacks on the public sector to make Greece have a public sector that is as small a part of the economy as it is in developing countries like Africa, rather than continuing to have a kind of share of the public sector that is comparable to other European Union countries.
Greece is in debt, and the richer countries are trying to put the screws on Greece and making the Greek government sell off some of their assets. Could you talk to us about what they're doing to Greece?
Yeah, what's going on now? Because the debt has become so great, so unmanageable, I mean, it's not possible for Greece really to pay its debt, and people know that. So one of the things that they are trying to do, there was an austerity package that was adopted last year that basically gave Greece $110 billion loans so that it could continue servicing its debt. But it had, of course, very conditions attached to that. that were very brutal for the average Greek. It's sort of a destruction of labor relations, drastic cuts of wages, pensions, drastic cutbacks in the, you know, public spending and the welfare state and so on and so forth. And now what's happening is that, as it often happens in the case of IMF programs, their predictions have not come true. The program did not work the way they said it was going to work. So now Greece needs another loan to continue servicing its debt. And their expectation that as a result of the program, Greece would be able to go out to the markets and get a loan at a reasonable rate has not materialized. So now what they're trying to do is they're trying to put together a new loan package so that Greece does not default on its debt. And one of the conditions is that basically Greece has this huge fire sale of all its public assets, and the expectation is, or the hope is, that it's going to raise 50 billion euros, which is about $70 billion, in the next few years. And, of course, the problem is that at the time of crisis, deep economic crisis, the values of all the public companies in the stock market have shrunk very rapidly. So basically, whoever buys these assets will buy them at a really low price that is not commensurate to the real value of these assets. So, you know, many Greeks are up in arms about that. And in general, I mean, Greeks right now have suffered a lot for the last year. They don't see these policies working. And now they see the government wanting to, you know, follow up on these policies that didn't work with more of the same. And that's why right now something like 80% of Greeks are opposed to these policies. So the Greek government is trying to shove these policies down people's throats using, you know, extreme police brutality, as we saw in the demonstrations a few days ago.
What are the Greek people doing to fight back?
Well, there have been there was a two-day general strike last week. 48-hour general strike had not happened in Greece for like decades. So that was a big development in itself. There had been general strikes, usually one-day strikes, in the past. So that was one development. But beyond that, there has been another development with basically ordinary Greeks taking to the streets, taking over squares, including the central square in Athens, the Syntagma Square, it means constitution, across from the parliament. And they were partly inspired by a similar movement that happened in Spain, that began in Spain in mid-May. People have been, you know, going out and basically expressing their dissatisfaction with these policies. You also have a kind of demand of, you know, real democracy, direct democracy. And you have basically, it's kind of interesting, the Syntagma Square is in the middle of the city. It's surrounded by symbols of capitalist power, from the parliament to luxury hotels, to the local McDonald's joint, to banks, and so on and so forth. And then in the midst of all that, you have a kind of liberated space of people basically organizing themselves into different groups in order to keep the movement going.
What demands, what concrete demands are they making?
Well, one of the focus points up to last week was so that the austerity package would not pass. So this was voted on the 28th, 29th. The discussion was between the 28th and 30th of June. And one of the things they called for is, you know, surrounding the parliament, and the idea would be to basically prevent from, you know, the discussion and the vote to happen. And now, of course, this they were not successful in achieving this. So I think the next challenge for the movement is to decide what will come next. Ever since that meeting, people went in meetings, subsequent meetings, people have first commented and discussed the extreme police brutality that was used by the government. But at the same time, they're starting to discuss, okay, what comes next? What should be our next demand? And I think, you know, this kind of situation of austerity measures is not going anywhere because Greece is under supervision from the IMF and the European Union. Every 3 months, there are new measures that have to be adopted in order for Greece to be able to get the next installment of the loan. So now the movement may subside a little bit as you get into, you know, the middle of the summer, and Greece is very hot in the summer. Once a movement like that takes place, nothing is the same anymore. And I expect that the resistance and the tensions will rise again, certainly in the fall.
I have a question. You know, we're coming, of course, at this crisis, you know, in the middle of it, really, with the loans already out there, with new loans for old loans, et cetera. But at this point, what choices are there really for Greece? I mean, going into default, what could the government do? I mean, if it doesn't want to impose the austerity packages of the big banks and the IMF, what are its real choices?
Well, I think one of the things that happens is that the Greek crisis is also a European crisis. And if Greece were to declare default on its loans, that would really affect the Eurozone in a very direct way. It would affect European banks, would create a domino effect where you have similar escalating problems for other peripheral countries like Ireland and Portugal. So from my point of view, this gives Greece some bargaining power where a Greek government that would really try to represent the interests of ordinary Greeks rather than the interests of local capitalists and foreign creditors would basically have to say, we cannot follow this kind of policies because these policies are making things worse. And if they were to say that, I think there could be a potential for Europe to actually back down and sort of reconsider the way they try to deal with this crisis. Because the way they try to deal with this crisis is to make ordinary Greeks, ordinary Portuguese people, ordinary Irish people pay for a European project that has been tailored according to the interests of the bankers. But I think one of the problems is what's happening now, I think, is the European Union is trying to buy some time so that when eventually Greece goes bankrupt, that the necessary adjustments have been made so that the European banks and all the other important, powerful actors in the European Union do not get affected very much. So in the meantime, for example, in the last year, many of the European banks that held the Greek sovereign debt have been unloading these bonds to the European Central Bank. So I think this is what's happening. Greece is racing against the clock. And it will probably, this kind of bargaining sort of trip that it has right now is going to become weaker and weaker as time passes and as Greece continues to go down this self-destructive road.
We're speaking from our New York studios to our guest, Professor Kostas Paniotakis, who's in Greece about 100 miles outside of Athens just now. He comes back to the United States in New York City and teaches, so he's got a foot in both places. And, you know, there's a crisis that's underway here in the United States, too. You pointed out that the rich aren't paying taxes, that business aren't paying their share of taxes in Greece, and that's also true in the United States. And it's also true that there's a big debt problem in the United States and austerity measures that the Congress wants to take. So my question to you is, what lessons can American people learn from the struggle that's going on now in Greece?
Well, I think the lesson to take from this is that fighting back is necessary, and the level of the fight back has to be much greater than anything that is going on right now. Because, I mean, the level of struggle in Greece is certainly much greater than it is in the United States, but it's still, the obstacles are very formidable. And there are certainly similarities here. I mean, the kind of this austerity juggernaut is global. In Greece, it takes the most extreme form. But, for example, in New York, I teach in the City University of New York. Basically, what you have is that the City University has faced cutbacks for like 30 years now, and it's facing cutbacks again and again and again, and it affects people's chance to get an education and to deal with a crisis that is catastrophic. And you have the conservative Democrats, just as we have a conservative socialist here. It's pretty clear that, you know, the only way that they will be accountable to their, to the people they should be representing as Democrats and socialists is if they have a really strong and determined movement fighting back.
Do you have any last thoughts for our audience before we say goodbye?
You know, it's important to realize oftentimes the mainstream media try to present the Greek crisis as something that has to do with a pathological Greek culture or a pathology of the Greek people. And this is what, you know, ideology always does. It tries to blame the victims of exploitation and oppression. There are similar things that always happen in the United States. Lots of the rhetoric about the public sector worker and their privileges and getting high wages and salaries and so on and so forth. I mean, it's interesting to me that the same rhetoric that they're using here, the same rhetoric is being used in the United States to attack public sector unions and public sector workers.
Thank you, Costas, for being with us today. A really informative interview.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.